Welcome to your first morning. It's a little chilly. One thing before I introduce Mr. Diogan is it probably is going to rain today. We do have umbrellas in all of our venues, but we'd like to keep them on campus. So if you're leaving campus,
we go now to a live discussion from the Aspen Ideas Festival titled What Will Drive Economic Success in the Next 20 Years? Corporate support for the Ideas Festival, broadcast on Aspen Public Radio, is provided by Obermeyer Wood Investment Council, an independent investment advisory firm that works with individuals, corporations, and foundations through its offices in Aspen and Denver.
He's number three at Facebook. He's about 32 years old and brilliant, and he's going to talk about connectivity and connecting everybody in the world, which is his job. So, with no further ado, I'd like to introduce to you a wonderful panel. We spent a lot of time this year working on the subject of capitalism and how we're going to rethink our system, inequality, the economic divide. Lots of really good conversations going to happen in this half, just in the nature of people's schedules, but we really have great content, so I hope you enjoy it. With no further ado, I'm going to introduce you to Nick, who is the editor-in-chief of business for CNBC, and take it away. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Kitty. Thanks for all of you being here. It's a great morning to be here, and we've got a great lineup. Our one goal here is to get... you don't need me, right? Okay. I think our one goal here is to have a little debate. Our other goal is to get one of these two guys maybe elected president or vice president, but we'll work on that. Look, seriously, I'm Nick Diogan. I've been in the business of business news about 25 years. I've been at CNBC for the last 6 years and the Wall Street Journal for 15 years before that. And I will say that in all my time covering business and the economy, I've never come across a more fascinating moment in time. We're obviously coming off the Brexit vote, which was, for what I do for a living, obviously incredibly interesting and exciting. But we are this strange moment where on the one hand, you have, in some ways, a rejection of some of the fundamental principles of capitalism around free trade and free markets. It's happening in the UK. It's happening over here. Obviously, we've seen in the election. It's funny. I was with last night with Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft, and Yuri Milner, and I was standing together, and we realized none of us had actually been born in the United States, and we'd all come here, and we were saying, if America doesn't stand up for free markets and fundamental capitalism, who will? That's not to say capitalism is perfect, and that's why we've got such a great group here for you today. And the second is we're in this period of phenomenal innovation that's happening. The things that we never thought would happen are fundamentally changing the economy, whether you call it the on-demand economy or the gig economy. We've had a burst of activity. And things that you would read about in the Jetsons are coming true. But that fundamentally alters the contract, the social contract between employers and employees. It raises some questions about what's the future of capitalism, what should it look like in the next 20 years, and what, if anything, should government do about it? Mark Weinberg, I'm going to start with you because you advise companies for a living. You advise all kinds of companies, and I want to start with something a little provocative, which is, should government be in the business of trying to change the rules of capitalism? Is what we have seen so profound in the last year that there should be a new form of capitalism that develops, or should the markets take care of itself, and is this the fundamental nature of capitalism that things will work themselves out, even if they aren't pretty along the way?
Sure. Well, thanks, Nick. I appreciate the easy question. I'm not sure. We are seeing unprecedented times, no doubt about it. I mean, the uncertainty that we have, political, geopolitical, economic, as you say, business model disruption, individual company disruption, is just causing havoc. And frankly, the income disparity and the people being left behind are getting their voice. And you were seeing that. If we didn't learn something from Brexit, we didn't learn something from the Trump phenomenon in the United States, then we're not paying attention, right? So there is a fundamental change right now. I'm not sure changing capitalism is the answer. My view has always been government is, I've spent half my career in government. I worked for two different administrations, one Republican, one Democrat, so I'm not being critical, but Government can't and doesn't have all the answers. Government needs to provide an environment, in my view, where business and private market and capitalism could prosper, and then take care of the problems where it's not working. And that's got to be consistently the case. Right now, what we're hearing and seeing is it's not working for a large portion of populations, not just in the United States. 8 years of frustration since 2008 has led to people really challenging whether they're left behind or not. And people make the worst decisions when they're scared and they're angry and they don't understand. And that's what we're seeing, I think, in the UK and some things around here.
Governor Daniels, in the past few years, has government been part of the solution or part of the problem?
Part of the problem. It's thanks, as always, to the Aspen Institute. Here I am sitting between maybe the two thought leaders in the country on the kind of questions, the implications anyway, of the situation Mark just described so well. We have two phenomena no one really is sure how best to deal with right now. One is lots of people dislocated, unemployed, underemployed, maybe gave up, or not participating at all. And how are we going to get them trained and ready for a job that's actually there today? And then secondly, we've got ever larger numbers of people no longer employed in the tradition, what we thought of as the traditional way of full-time employment, but in contingent, temporary, come-and-go work. And so here are just two or three quick reflections on all that. The first one is that no matter what one's point of view on any of these issues, I just think it's an important predicate. We will never address any of them at 1.x% economic growth. It's the enemy of full-time employment. It's the enemy of equality of income. If we don't get to a faster growth track, and I think it's largely been conscious government decisions that have held us back, then we are just dealing with the casualties, and we'll not catch up to it. Second, we have to decide whether we want or don't want the so-called gig economy. Mark's research has shown is a little too glib. That's this much of a much bigger phenomenon. It has its upsides. The students on our campus, I think, relish the idea of lots of different jobs, maybe two at a time, of careers that are really flexible and individualized. But as I tell them all the time, you're not America. And this may work out well for you, but how about that much greater number of people, young and old, who aren't well suited to that? And what are we going to do? This is where Mark's leading us. What are we going to do to provide a safety net for them? But I just have to say, if we don't want a more contingent economy, then we're sure behaving strangely, because I can give you a long list of things that are forcing people out of full-time employment. 30 hours a week, no more than 50 employees, or you're caught in the clutches of the Affordable Care Act. On college campuses and in high schools in my state, 30 hours is it, and has been now for a year or two. And overtime rules, paid sick leave, one thing after another is telling businesses, operate with as few full-time employees as you can. So we need to decide, maybe we could stop propelling this phenomenon, at least until Mark shows us how best to deal with it. And my very last point is, someone's coined this term techno-optimist. That's been me all my life. History shows that a dynamic free economy creates a net plus as it automates or otherwise modernizes technologically. And I sure hope that's the case now. But and there are reasons to think that. But there are an awful lot of people out there who are still employed who are very vulnerable
because I think I want us to get back to that point, because I think the changes in technology and the idea of productivity and how it's affecting people is a very meaty subject. Senator Warner, you start as an entrepreneur. You've talked about how you're a hardcore capitalist, but you believe short-term capitalism is killing us. A, what did you mean by that? But B, tell us about the research you've been doing, and then Zoe, I want you to talk about this too, in terms of what the future should look like and what people want it to look like.
Well, again, Nick, thank you for that, and great to be back at Aspen. In many ways, my journey in this started last year at this festival, and Mitch has been kind enough to help, and Zoe and Mark have been kind enough to help. I've found a lot of different things. Let me try to take gig contingent and maybe in a subsequent comment, because I do agree with Mark on some things, but I do think there are fundamentally different things happening in capitalism right now that were very different than 30 years ago. And some of that is going to require either continuing government policies or changing. One, a year ago, we talked about changing nature of work and how we were all, at least I was, infatuated with this notion of the gig sharing on-demand economy. The Ubers, the Airbnbs, the Lyfts, the Handys, the TaskRabbits. Exciting phenomena, the ability to, in effect, purchase a skill set a la carte as opposed to the whole package. Lindsey Graham had to endure a whole pitch from me for an hour on this, and he said, Mark, you're saying work is changing in the way we used to buy cable TV and you had to buy the whole package, even if you only wanted HBO and ESPN, now you can buy a la carte. Same thing in work. You used to have to buy the whole person 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year. Now you can buy that skill a la carte. But the gig piece is actually relatively small. What it masks, though, or what is behind that is a phenomenon that started to take place back in the 90s as everyone, and public corporations in particular, that was not core to the function got outsourced. Not necessarily literally, but if you were a cafeteria worker or the person who cleaned up the office, you were no longer an employee of the corporate. You got outsourced to a different source with a whole different working relationship. Now 35% of the workforce is in some form, as Mitch mentioned, of contingent work, whether it's an independent contractor, whether it's a sole entrepreneur, whether it's a part-time work, whether it's a temporary W-2. And we spent a while looking at this whole 1099 W-2 labor classification. It's a mess. You cannot have a binary choice. But this contingent work now makes up about 35% of the workforce. Here's what we need to be concerned on that. Because I agree with Mitch, we want the innovation to continue, the flexibility. But with that portion of the workforce, there's, I believe, an economic free rider problem because none of that section of the workforce has any social insurance. Any of the social contract that was created in the 1930s and 40s, works in comp, disability, health, retirement, unemployment, doesn't come with this new status. And Zoe will comment in a moment about the fact that this section of the economy is going to dramatically grow.
So, go ahead.
Let me just finish one piece here, and I won't, because I know I've got a lot I would like to share. But my hope is that as we move forward, we're going to have to think from a policy standpoint about how we create portable benefits that aren't attached to work. I believe so that any income you receive, no matter what classification, a slice of it would attach to you. Who manages that, I think, is a jump ball. Doesn't have to be government. Could be private sector. Could be new guilds, associations. And if we could wave a magic policy wand and make that happen, here's one of the cool opportunities. Is if we could create a new 21st century social contract, before we simply port over all the same programs, we actually have a chance to reimagine it. The same technology and algorithm that brings your Uber to your door in the new emerging fintech world are creating tools that can allow what would be called income smoothing. Because if you have a lot of income coming at disparate periods of time, how do you make sure that is managed against your expenses? How do we actually think, potentially, that we could create something that might have that reserve $400 expense fund, because we've all seen the data that shows 47% of Americans couldn't absorb a $400 unexpected bill without going into a debt spiral, payday lenders or others. There's actually a chance to reinvent a social contract that could be, I think, forward-leaning, allow the innovation, and quite honestly, in my day job, we're not putting a lot of points on the board. Figuring out a social contract, I don't know if that's, for the 21st century, whether that's a Democrat or Republican idea, but it is one that policymakers are going to have to grapple with.
So Zoe, address the, Mark alluded to this, and Governor Daniels did too. Is how much of the contingent workforce is out of necessity? It's a hard question to answer. And how much of it is, there's a fundamental shift that's happening, and also in terms of how people think about work?
Yeah, so let me frame up the question this way. We're going through now the biggest disruption in the workforce in 100 years, the biggest disruption since we moved from an agricultural society to an industrial age. And we're moving from this industrial age to a digital economy. And the people who voted in Brexit, the people who are angry at our government, the people who are feeling displaced in our economy, whether they're Trump supporters or who they're supporting, are feeling this. I mean, all the polls show that people don't see their place. The single most compelling and important goal that we have today is to enable people to see their place in the digital economy. And that is a huge national challenge. It's a huge challenge for leaders of all kinds, business leaders, political leaders, wherever you want to assign the responsibility for every individual to help people see their place in the digital economy.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by see their place?
So people need to know what to learn, what skills to develop, what to tell their kids to study, how to create economic opportunity, and what their communities will look like. So it's not just a matter of a gig economy question. Am I going to have one job for a lifetime, like the issue used to be? Will I have seven employers? The data shows, you know, that people are more likely to have seven employers over the course of a lifetime than a single employer. We just did a poll that we're releasing today that we worked on together. And I think the single most interesting finding in that poll is not that the gig economy is growing, but rather that 60% of employers want full-time employees.
They actually want people to stay.
Their preference is they want full-time employees, and over 70% of them are prepared to invest in benefits. Mitch and I were part of a 55-person group called Rework America that wrote a book, put out a book called America's Moment. You can find it you can find it on Amazon, or we're happy to get it to you. And what grew out of that were achievement plan, where Starbucks is enabling their employees to get a college degree online through Arizona State University while they're employed by Starbucks. That's to retain people. It's because turnover, I mean, it's nice to employees, but the turnover is costly for companies. And a lot of you in the audience, I know you're CEOs or retired CEOs, you know this. Turnover is costly. This study showed that 70% of employers are prepared to invest in benefits for employees because they get loyalty from employees. One of the really important things that we're finding is that this digital economy is requiring rapid retraining and skills. Five of the six top reasons that people are hiring independent contractors now, and the growth in that, five of the six top reasons are to get the skills they need quickly, to hire people quickly when there's a surge. We know the data shows that it takes longer to find the middle skills you need, the skills for people who don't have a college diploma. It takes longer to find those skills for today's growth jobs. And the problem is that we're not training people to the skills that are needed in today's economy as quickly as they're needed. So if we can create rapid retraining so that people can move into these jobs quickly, both retraining on the job and retraining
So you're saying employers are more interested in a longer-term relationship.
Yes.
Are the employees in your survey more interested as well?
So we don't know that.
I want to
go
to Mark Weinberger with this in a second, because Mark, you hire with 60,000 people a year?
Yeah, we have a quarter of a million people, so we hire about 60,000 a year. Yeah.
So this is a great question. If employers want a longer-term relationship, you're a big employer. Do you want a longer-term relationship, and do you feel the same? Do you feel employees want a longer-term relationship? Or do they feel a little more, you know, they want to be moving around a little more?
Well, you bifurcate it, right? I mean, first of all, there's no one employee. They're all different.
Sure.
And some need more. There's no doubt in my mind.
But you're building a better world, according to you.
We're building a better working world every day. That's right. But when 75% of the families today either have a single parent or two working parents, and so they need more flexibility. Bottom line, you're going to have more flexibility in the workplace. Millennials, we did a study with 70% of our 250,000 people are Generation Y, and they will work at many different places before they retire, unlike, you know, in the past, people would earn a pension and want to stay at one place forever. They want to go and have different experiences, and they want a purpose behind what they're doing. I would like to just make one comment, Nick, if I could. I'm going back to my good friend, the senator here. All the changes you were all talking about work, are absolutely right. We are seeing the most fundamental changes in work that I've ever seen in my professional career. But that doesn't mean capitalism is changing, in my view, because it is no different than when 70 or 80% of our economy was agriculture and it went to many other different things. We had to retrain our workforce back then, too. It is completely in our history to evolve. And I think the biggest change and the problem I see with what's happening, and this goes back to your role of government, there is a lack of trust in the leaders today in big business, in government, and anybody else to lead us through this change. I don't think anyone's looking for government to have all the answers. In fact, government writes static laws that cannot respond to all this change. Business, government, the NGOs have to come together and figure this out. When we tell everybody around, you know, today, you're going to lose your job in your district because of this manufacturing plant's closing because of a trade deal, so we're anti-trade, we're lying to our people that the answer is to put a figurative wall here, not a literal wall, around us when 90% of all people under 30 live in an emerging market and 95% of consumers are outside the United States. We can't do that anymore. We got to come up with better answers and solutions.
Well, I guess that's the gist of my original question and the thinking behind it. And Senator Warner, when you talk about the government, I'm concerned you're going to create yet another government program. And when I listen to Mark Weinberg, he's in his head, he's thinking, oh boy, here we go again. How do you avoid that?
I think if I could just add one comment, I really want to endorse the notion that we have to find a way to make government as nimble and fast moving as the changes that are happening. And if we can't do that, it's going to be an institution of the past and will fail our people. I think there is no question, but that is one of our greatest challenges.
Let me first of all agree with Mitch. There's a lot of things. Let's take the double-edged sword of ACA. You would not have the innovation and people taking kind of some of the risks around gig if you hadn't disconnected health coverage.
You really think
work so? Steps. Yes. Now, the flip side of that is there were a lot of things in ACA that were totally screwed up. 30-hour cliffs and a whole host of others. But let me go to the point on capitalism. And again, I spent longer as a business guy than I have in politics.
We should remind people that
20-plus years, successful. Co-founder of Nextel, venture guy, telecom. But the capitalism that I grew up with is different than the capitalism of today. And I think this is part a creature of government policy. You know, 45, 50 years ago, average tenure of hold of public stock was 8 years. Today it's 4 months. 30 years ago, 50% of corporate profits, public company profits, were reinvested in their business. Today, 95% are stock buybacks and dividends. Tell me something's not screwy with capitalism when iconic American companies with hundreds of billions of dollars on their balance sheet borrow money to do stock buybacks. That's not capitalism. That is financial manipulation of a system, and that is partially driven by government policy. The corporation is an entity of the state. It is a creature of the state. What it is, one way or the other, the state can determine. I think there have been slow changes in this. Responsibility, again, particularly around public corporates, is valued to shareholders, but also to other constituencies. Your employees, your communities, elsewhere.
But shouldn't the blowback of that come from the shareholders themselves and not from government?
I think that listen, we have, and I would agree, big government static is becoming less trusted, less nimble, less effective. Globalization, technology, AI, and short-termism, a short-termism now that didn't exist 30 years ago or even 20 years ago, is saying how to become more and more effective. And the first thing that's eliminated is human capital. Now, good skilled workers, they're going to be fine. The folks you're hiring are going to be fine. Low and moderate income Americans, enormous disruption and displacement. I mean, just think about the terminology. You invest in a piece of equipment that's an asset. You invest in the kind of training that Zoe's talking about just on your balance sheet. That's a cost. All I'm saying is somebody who wants capitalism to work, we need to slightly shift the emphasis so that reinvesting in human capital is a little higher on the food chain. And I would argue, and I don't want to take too much time here, but there are a series of things, both public and private, that can happen. There is a series of public efforts, because I do believe millennials want to work for and buy from responsible companies. Public series of efforts that government will have nothing to do with. They're going to try to find, what are those metrics? The Paul Tudor Jones with Just Capital, the B Corp movement that Zoe's so familiar with, the Sustainability Index, inclusive capitalism, conscientious capital, a whole series of movements. I do think there are series that government can be involved in around corporate governance. I do believe differential capital gains rate based on longer term holds, more incentives for patient capital, maybe even corporate governance rules that say longer term additional voting powers for longer term holds on corporate stocks. And there are absolutely things that public policymakers can do, particularly around training. You know, candidly, the folks at NY and everyone kind of further up, I think they will sort through. Everybody under $75,000 pay as a cut line in this country. I am very worried that they're on the chopping block, and the investment criteria of a company investing in those people, we have to figure out, because government, again, I would agree, doesn't do a great job on this. How do we incent that public or private entity to actually invest in that person, even if that person moves around? Maybe part of the tail on that benefit goes a year out. There's going to have to be, I think, a lot of creative thinking here, or if not, the Sanders, Trump, Brexit anger, and we don't have the, well, we just got to reform education for the next 20 years. We don't have the luxury of another generation to figure this out. This needs to have a greater sense of urgency than, frankly, what I deal with on my day job.
Governor Daniels, do you agree with that?
I do. I've been listening and trying to learn all I can from Mark on this question. I do think that a whole new set, and I think it should be a replacement, frankly, that individualizes and makes portable benefits so that people are protected in and out of employment is a great thing to work on. And no question that the systems we have today are relics. I still think that the big bogey to keep our eye on, however, is the net trade-off of the technological disruption that we're all watching and learning about. You know, in the past, when we transitioned from one economy to another, there was people who were displaced from one kind of routine work, found other routine
right.
work. The routine of the farm gave way to the routine of the factory and so forth. It wasn't hard to make that transition. What Zoe's work gets at is we have something very different going on now. There is no routine work left. It's either been offshored or automated, and what's been offshored, I think, is very likely to come back. You know, someone has written that offshoring is the way station on the way to automation. You know, automation is simply low-cost labor by a different means, lower cost. So I hope that we will see that the economy, if we don't unnecessarily stifle and choke it, once again generates new employment opportunities that we didn't see coming, that more than replace the old in both quantity and quality. It's just
and
harder.
That's the big question.
That is the question.
Harder right to on. See it coming now. Now, you know, bank tellers, ATMs, et cetera, made banks, bank branches, everybody thought they'll disappear. No, they wound up with more employees than they had because it was cheaper to have one in the first place. There are examples in which the greater productivity of the new technology creates new demand. And we all can go out and buy things that only the wealthy or no one could buy before, mm-hmm. and new jobs come into existence because of it. It's just not as obvious this time. But what is obvious is that if we're so fortunate that yet again a dynamic free economy creates these new opportunities, they're going to have a different and better educated worker to fill them, and that those people are much less likely than before to be in long-term, let alone permanent employment, and we've got to have Warner program to take care of them.
Address also what Senator Warner was alluding to, which is should government, because I know there was talk about this yesterday as well, should government be involved with altering, whether it's the tax code or other things, to allow for more long-term investments? And do you worry about the unintended consequences of that?
Anytime government lifts a finger, you better worry about unintended consequences, because there always are some, and they're not usually positive. I absolutely think so. If you could say, if only to help clean up a mess they've helped create. But I'm going to, I can't answer your question without going returning to the central point. We've got to stop. It would be helpful if government stopped making hiring people so expensive. We pile one rule, one mandate, one tax, one reg on top of the other, you know, and then we wonder why fewer people get hired. It costs more to do it. So they find, you know, you find another way, you hire E and Y to figure out how to...
Yeah. Nothing wrong with this. I think it's a good idea.
So, yes, I think we do have a new reality. I think that if we could go to general quarters on a pro-growth program, that's the sine qua non of this. And if we had that kind of growth, we would still have the problems. I'm going to say the opportunities to do what Mark wants to do, which is create a new regime suited to an age of more autonomous, more flexible, constantly learning and changing and career-changing workers.
Mark, you want to say something to that? I want to ask you a question.
Yeah, I just want to say, so I think a lot of people would feel a lot more confident if more people like Senator Warner were making all the decisions, let's say, around what to do.
Did you see the George Will column about?
Yes.
He's going to have to run as an independent.
I've been talking to Mitch for a long time about running, but the reality is you've got these polarization, and you've got these scaremongers who are creating policies that, first of all, they think that we can fix it all from Washington, or we can't do anything in Washington. Neither are right. You need both. You definitely need both. And the stalemate has left a vacuum for business to come in and fill. And frankly, the business community has not been that great. There's a lot of criticism about the pay of executives, governance, a lot of things that we've lost credibility in a voice at the table. So somehow that lack of trust is all these people who have lost confidence and we're taking them on this journey and have a place, as you described, Zoe, I think is the challenge. I have no doubt we can figure this out. This is not the hardest problem we've ever faced as a country in our history. But we're not working together, and the polarization is so extreme, we've got to find a way through that. And I just believe government, you know, has a role, but they can't do it. I think business has to lead.
So, Zoe, respond to that, but I also want you to think about it. So tell us what you know from the research you've done also on the shifting relationship between employers and employees, but also from the employer perspective. You know, Mark hires people, we hire people, we provide them benefits, we provide them all kinds of things which... is a big cost. How much do employees want that, appreciate that, feel that's a given as part of the contract with the employer?
Let's start with the really practical question of what it looks like to get from here to there is the context for that relationship between employer and employee. Have any of you heard Governor Hickenlooper talk about Skillful here in Colorado? You have? Okay. So let's not paint government with a really broad brush, okay? You don't like to paint corporations with a really broad brush, so let's not paint government with a really broad brush. Here in Colorado, Governor Hickenlooper has called up every business leader.
Another former businessman, by the way.
Another former businessman.
Brew pub owner.
Right. And said, we have to reskill people in the state and get them into the high-growth jobs. And we've got a new form of post-secondary education. It's not the college diploma. 70% of Americans don't get a college diploma. We've set them on a path to think they're failures. We're going to give them another path. And that path is going to be to get the skills that are needed for the high growth jobs. And we have this platform called skillful.com. We actually created it at Markle with LinkedIn. So it's outside of government. And we're trying to make it work here. And we're going to try to grow it in the country so you can look at it. But the point of this is that it's outside of government, but it can't happen without the engine of government promoting it among businesses in the community and the workforce centers of the state are the input for the people, although we actually have the people who ran the Obama ground game and running a ground game to see if we can use that technique to find the people who could benefit from it the most, using that data analytics and ground game to bring people in. But the reason I mention this in the context of your question is that the employer-employee relationship that we're trying to build is one of employers. We're doing a deep dive into the skills that these employers need. So we're working with data analytics from Burning Glass and the Labor Department, which has done, really the Federal Labor Department has done incredibly rich work that employers themselves have not done on what the skills are that are needed for jobs. So there again, the public-private partnership, EY has not done the deep work on what skills are needed for jobs. And we're taking that public information and we're bringing it to employers and saying, okay, write your job descriptions on a skills basis, not college diploma and 4 years of experience. And we're putting that into LinkedIn, and LinkedIn has built a training finder so that job seekers and employers can look at what is the training that is available at community colleges and boot camps and online for the jobs that they have to fill. So they can send their employees to the training finder to find the training that they need. Free training in some places. ASU has free training, and community colleges and for-profit training. Galvanize in Denver, $14,000 a year, and you're guaranteed a job. So all of this is a public-private collaboration. Right. So that contract between employers and employees becomes totally different, because an employer says, you know, I'll hire you. I mean, in Phoenix, companies like AT&T say, you go to Galvanize and I'll hire you if you come out of Galvanize with a certificate that costs you $14,000 and I'll guarantee you a job. And so it's a completely different kind of relationship, but it's based on detailed defined skills that you obtain and the employer gets the skills they need.
So that's a great segue to Governor Daniels, because you have a unique insight from, you know, being government, being in the private sector, and now running a large educational institution. Two questions. One is, are we overvaluing and overemphasizing a more traditional type of education when the job market may have changed for everyone? Are we trying to do too much of a one-size-fits-all? And the second is, you have done, talk a little bit about what you've done at your institution in terms of freezing, I believe, the tuition rate, which, as we know from all the rallies around the country, is student debt is such a giant millstone for so many young people and is affecting how they think about capitalism as well.
Thank you for leading the witness. I'll take you up on the offer. Well, to the first question, yes, of course. Higher education as we've known it still has its place, and I think if it those institutions that make the right changes are likely to still be very highly valued and sought after and likely to survive and thrive. The market is calling into existence all kinds of new ways to get to productive life, and Zoe just gave you some great examples, and more power to them. We need more. I think the greatest people seem to, a lot of people fasten on the technological threats to higher education, the opportunity to acquire it remotely and take advantage of the new technologies, and that's real, and that's going to grow. I think the greater threat, but it's an opportunity for society, is alternative certifications of various kinds. And more and more employers, including big ones you've heard of, are saying, we don't care where you went to school, because we don't know what that diploma means anymore. Everybody gets an A at that school. And the diploma...
Except at Purdue, I'm sure. Except at yours.
Except at Purdue. We still have one of the lowest average GPAs, and it's not because our kids aren't bright. That's a different subject. But anyway, I think that to some extent higher ed has brought this on itself by not delivering unimpeachable value. I sometimes say to business audiences, now look, here's the business you really wanted to go into. You're selling something seen as a necessity. You got to have that diploma. And there's no measurement of quality. Nobody can tell whether the student at school A learned more than grew more, is more prepared than the student at school B. And there's total price pricing power. You not only don't, when you raise the tuition, you not only don't lose customers, right. You gain customers, because in the absence of any other evidence, people go, oh, a higher sticker price. Hmm. I always said, who gets to do business that way? My wife said, well, Tiffany's. Okay, there's one, but I mean, right?
And you just need a little blue box and go with your diploma.
So anyway, that game's up. You know, $1.3 trillion of student debt sort of is called that game for what it is. And so now there are rightful demands to prove value and rightful demands to deliver it. The basic equation of life is quality divided by cost. And so we're working on both ends. And just to be very brief about the commercial, thank you again for the chance. We froze tuition at Purdue the year I got there. It's still frozen at that level, and it will be for the next 2 years. So that's five total. It's actually less expensive to go to our school now because we cut the cost of room, board, and books. And yet we've invested heavily in faculty and research and quality and in the measurement of how much our students are growing. And I guess just want to tell you this one little anecdote. When I first suggested that, saying, listen, I said to those folks, look, I just landed from Mars. But back on Mars, people were upset about the cost of college. And I think we ought to make some kind of statement that we hear and that we're going to try to work a little harder on this. So there was one set of folks that, oh my gosh, we'll go broke and turn out the lights. And I said, I don't think we could scrape by. But the more interesting reaction was the enrollment people who said, oh gee, if we do that and we don't raise our price while all our competitors do, people will think we don't have confidence in the product. Wow. And I said, is that how you think? People think. And so anyway, to end it, the story, this spring, we had, for the third year in a row, record applications, record everything, and the same enrollment people, I said, great, what drove it? They said, our reputation for caring about cost. So that's the story from our end, but I do think that the market will continue to call into existence all sorts of new providers and new ways of certifying that somebody's ready for work, and none too soon.
I mean, just one, if we had more educational leaders as innovative as Mitch, this wouldn't be as much of a problem. He's also trying out some very cool things called Backup Boilermaker that are very innovative about how students can get through university with actually some shared risk, shared upside, that I think is an extraordinarily cool idea. And I think one of the things that Zoe's mentioned, this is going to require a collaboration between higher ed and business, because quite honestly, government doesn't do a very good job on retraining. We spend about $18 billion a year, but not necessarily with the right output. So I'm all in. There are some low-hanging fruit things that we could do. I'll give you one example, and then I got to end on a challenge again, though. Right now, a company, if they want to send an employee back to school at Purdue, the company can spend up to $5,200 a year, pre-tax dollars, sending that employee to school to continue their education. Good program, good training. But that same company can't apply that same $5,200 pre-tax against student debt. Mm-hmm. Why not allow that same benefit to be applied against student debt? Great retention tool, great ability to kind of bring that. I'm not going to solve student debt problems entirely. But it is, again, a low-hanging, common-sense opportunity to take advantage of. So, and I actually am very optimistic about our millennials and anyone's at any of our great institutions, how they're going to do. But if we look at whether the demographics around the Trump supporters or the demographics particularly around the Leave folks in the UK, there are a whole series of folks who are past that college age who are really worried about what's the transformation going on. Let me give you one thing that we'll deal with before the end of the year, I hope. I have been a longtime supporter of trade. TPP, I think, America ought to set the rules for how we deal with Asia.
And you are a Democrat.
And I think there are ways. If you've got to have strong enforcement laws, I think you got to have environmental, labor protections, what have you. But in all of us, and if there's one thing that we should learn from the Brexit vote, although I think there's a lot of morning after now, you know, having all the data alone isn't going to sway the race. You know, I can tell you a lot of communities in my state that still think that it was NAFTA that killed those textile jobs. And disproportionately, winners in trade are in metropolitan areas, losers in trade are in rural communities where there's a single employer. We believe, those of us who advocate trade, will say, well, we're going to add, and this is where I think we're going to have to rethink, you know, how we deal with the winners and losers around trade. I'll give you two examples. One is we think that TPP, experts have said, you know, it'll add close to $1 trillion to our economy over a decade. Well, if we're adding over $1 trillion of winners over a decade, the amount in TPP right now in terms of taking care of the losers on the so-called TAA, which is frankly a program that needs to be totally reworked, that retraining workers who are lost, is $4.5 billion. That's less than one-half of 1%. And quite honestly, that's not a fair trade. If we really believe our numbers about the upside, we need to do a lot more to help folks who are dislocated by trade. We know by sectors who's going to be some of the biggest winners in trade.
How much pressure is there on you to not support TPP right now?
Well, there's huge pressure on both sides. I'm for it. But I do believe to have it get through, you've got both presidential candidates opposed, you're going to need a reworking around what we do with folks who are dislocated. We know the winners. My old sector of tech, advanced manufacturing. Now, this may not require government, but it's going to require some level of public-private collaboration to say the winners in trade need to start taking the winnings and actually try to locate some of those jobs in the communities that have been dislocated by trade. We're going to need, I think, if we don't take a moment and rethink how we take care of folks who are dislocated by trade, then this same, and this goes to a whole set of folks who are candidly, who are not going to be starting at UVA or Purdue. They're 30s, 40s, 50-year-olds, and this is where, again, I think this notion of retraining, this whole notion of between investment around capital and labor, the labor piece is going to have a focus and a reimagining that candidly is not going on in Washington.
So if Hillary tomorrow says, you're going to be my running mate, do you have to change your support for TPP?
I'm for TPP, but I'm for TPP recognizing that we're going to have to end up with a much more robust, and it doesn't all have to be government, but a much more robust focus notion on those communities that are not going to be winners through this transition.
Last comment, and I want to take some questions.
So I just want to—I couldn't agree more with what the senator said. I don't think TPP or any trade deal is going to happen unless we recognize that we have to explain to the large population that will be disrupted how they're going to be taken care of. And it goes back to Zoe's point earlier, got to see what's your role. It is not just trade. It's technology. It's the whole host of issues that are causing disruption. But what we can't do, I don't think, is say there's not going to be disruption. Don't worry about it. There will be. It'll be quite significant, whether it is trade or technology. And then you own up to the problem, as you're saying, Mark. We don't have the right training programs. You guys all talked about the training programs. That's got to become part of it. But what we don't talk about also is the positives. Remember, all those people who are we're not reaching out to, we don't talk about how benefited they are by the price of goods and services that they get is so much lower than it would be because the supply chain, when you buy a car here today, it's made in 30 different countries.
If we start
putting walls up, it's going to go up.
I'd like to take you to Danville, Virginia, Main Street, right, and try to make that case.
I get it, because we can't make it, we can't hide it, saying.
All right, some time for questions. I see a question right here. The woman in the white.
It was easy.
Something. Yeah. Right over there. And I want to commend, while we're waiting for that, commend Governor Daniels for freezing tuition without government intervention. No one asked you to do it. So when everyone talks about government freezing CEO pay as well, it's worth keeping in mind.
Hi, Ellen Sabin. Thank you. So Zoe spoke about workforce development, and you've been speaking a lot about training current employees. But Mark brought up, you know, really profound data about emerging markets being abroad, a huge number of emerging markets being abroad. So I'm curious, what do we teach? This is about capitalism for our children and our grandchildren, how to make it succeed. What do we teach children, elementary school kids, in critical thinking? What are the sort of bullet points of what to teach so that the emerging markets that are coming up, our children and grandchildren can work in them and succeed?
Wow, that's a great question. And first of all, I'd start with, we can't be afraid of the emerging markets. You started off with the incredible immigrants we've had who've done incredibly well here, and instead of keeping them out, we should embrace them. They're incredible entrepreneurs. They lead a lot of our Fortune 500 companies. We can expand the pie. And so one is not to pretend like it's them, not us. Two, this is a huge difference. 95% of the consumers in the world are outside the United States today, 80% of GDP growth, 90% are 30. We can't pretend that we're going to have a U.S. economy that's going to put walls up around our industry. So I think we have to think more globally and teach our kids that at a younger level, diversity matters, not just gender diversity, but diversity of thought, diversity of where people are coming from. The more, and our kids are exposed to that more than we were, and they're getting it, but sometimes our leaders don't get it.
But it gets to the fundamental issue of, are people outside this country, have they benefited more to your, that's your point about me, have they benefited more from trade and opening up borders than people over here? And that gets to your point about the person in Danville. And I think that's a great question, because it is fundamentally seen it through an either-or prism, as opposed to it has lifted everybody, and the consumer benefits over here are often not explained enough, frankly. Yep. And it's hard to.
There is an issue that hasn't gotten enough attention yet either, which is the tremendous opportunity we have to use digital commerce to expand small and medium-sized businesses in the U.S. by exporting our services into the burgeoning middle class around the world, which, I mean, for example, health and wellness services, baby care, baby products, in countries all over the world that come from the U.S. because of the quality standards that are understood to exist in the U.S. that can seamlessly be done over the internet, whether they be goods or services. So there really is a tremendous opportunity to grow our economy because of the burgeoning middle class around the world, which we really haven't focused on enough. And can be a great boon for small and medium-sized enterprises. eBay, we've done some work with eBay, which shows that of those American companies that use the eBay platform, over 90% are exporters, small and medium-sized businesses, where only 3% of small and medium-sized businesses of identical nature are exporters if they don't use a platform like eBay. So it's a great business opportunity.
No, look, I hate to bring back Brexit, but that's what a lot of people are waking up to, I think, in the Post. I was with six members of YPO last night, many of them, one of whom has a business, does essentially fresh market, salads, et cetera, and he relies on free movement of goods over there, and that's tough, and employs
right.
a lot of people.
Right.
Another question, gentleman right over here.
Hi. Oh, sure. Hi. David Prizer. Senator Warner, you mentioned sharing the benefits of trade and counting the winners and spreading that around. And I would pick up on something that the governor said, which was that it's really about technology. And isn't trade sort of a special case of the advancement of technology? And shouldn't we be broadening our thinking, saying, why don't we capture the benefits of technology? And free globalization of trade is all enabled by the advancement of technology, and start counting all of the incredible surplus generated by technology and thinking about how we can spread some of those benefits to the losers to make it more acceptable all around and to buoy up all the boats, as we talk about.
Well, again, I know the data points, and I can reel them off. But when you live in a small community where the largest employer shuts their door and says, we're moving, that disproportionately affects that community in a hugely fundamental way. And again, I don't have a magic bullet here, but I do think our efforts in the past have not worked that well. Supported NAFTA, I think TAA had there were a lot of things I can tell you in my state where people got trained because it was not that public-private collaboration. People got trained for jobs that didn't exist. in that community elsewhere.
Go Nick.
I think there would also just one other way. I do think we're going to need an engagement with those, particularly sectors who are winners, to urge them. You know, I think about my tech friends. Not all the jobs need to be in Silicon Valley or in Northern Virginia or in Research Triangle. You know, we believe in the value of globalization, that you can build it in Mumbai or Shanghai. We ought to show you can also build it in Southside Virginia and Western Pennsylvania.
That's a great point.
We're talking here about the emotional content of one of the many debates, the trade debate, and how it's taken primacy over logic and reason and data and so forth. And I think one thing we shouldn't quit on without at least agreeing to all think about, I think about it a lot, you know, there's much more to work than making money. Work is where the sense of purpose and usefulness and fulfillment in life comes from. The earned success is the correlate that Arthur Brooks has taught us, the strongest correlate of human happiness, the sense that you've done something of value. And so what I worry about, I spent really 10 years traveling in, sleeping in a state just like Mark's talking about. And even if the dynamics even if growth returns, and even if the jobs of yesterday are replaced fully by, there's still a winner-take-all aspect to the economy we have now. Mark's got clients with a literal handful of people who are worth jillions of dollars.
That's a technical term, by the way.
the thriving companies that so often we see now, I tried, Mark. Most technologically, they could go anywhere. You can do business from anywhere in the globe, but people don't choose to. Why? Because these young people we're talking about and workers, skilled workers, don't want to be there. A data point just came out in my home state. 40% of the entire, call it GDP, of the state of Indiana is now in one city, the metro area around Indianapolis. It's booming. But at the expense, and I don't know if we can reverse that. So the question I think about a lot, the easy way out, nothing easy here, the straightest path to solving these problems, frankly, would be to give up and to say, that's the way the world's going to be. So we're going to redistribute negative income tax, universal income, basic income. We're going to make sure financially, materially, to just take care of folks and we'll have some fairness in society, but we won't have a happy and satisfied society if huge numbers of people do not feel they are useful in life, useful to a spouse, useful to their children, useful to other people. And that's why I hope we'll go the route that these folks are working on with all the difficulties attached to it. So that, and I for one would be prepared to give up a few points of national income 20 years from now if we had a workforce once again where men and women were occupied, I hope, full-time mostly, and doing things that reinforce their human dignity and sense of purpose in life.
That's a great point. That's a great point. We have time for one last question by the gentleman right over there. Thank you.
Frank Malab from Australia. For several years, Robert Putnam presented to this festival, and he spoke from the perspective of research he was doing on the very bottom. And he spoke in terms of there being a tsunami of disenfranchised people here in the United States. My question is, how large is that disenfranchised group? In my experience in Australia, working with some groups who were dealing with the bottom, you found people who were so out of the culture that they don't even understand the language that you've all been speaking.
That's a great question. I think we'll probably find out in November too.
I can give you just a couple of data points. You know, 35% of the workforce is in this contingent. Not all of them are by any means unhappy or unstable, but they don't have any social insurance. And that number is going to dramatically increase. 47% of Americans can't absorb an unexpected $400 bill without going into hock. I believe income inequality is a huge challenge. I also think income insecurity is equally a huge challenge. We see enormous disaffection in both political parties. And I think the challenge is, you know, and part of this, listen, the folks in my line of work, we've not been putting a lot of points on the board. To Mark's point, you know, we spend more time shooting spitballs back and forth rather than getting things done. I do think there will be a reset in January, whoever wins. But if we don't find a way to kind of reframe the arguments, you know, I think around things like a new social contract or making capitalism work for a broader group of people, then you're going to get back into the same pre-established positions that folks have already got. I didn't directly answer my question.
That's a great point. It's a great point, and remind everyone that, look, it's for all the doom and gloom, I'm fundamentally an optimistic person. Amen. I agree with Governor Daniels. I think that was a great point. And if you think of everything this country has gone through, and the amazing resilience and ability to welcome people and to innovate and to find solutions to all the things we've talked about. Mark, you made the point, these aren't intractable. These are solvable problems. And we've got some of the smartest people here who are at the forefront of solving them. I want to thank all of you. I want to thank the Aspen students for being here. Thank you very much.
Okay, sure.
You've been listening to a live broadcast of What Will Drive Economic Success in the Next 20 Years from the Aspen Ideas Festival at the Aspen Institute. Corporate support for the Ideas Festival broadcast on Aspen Public Radio is provided by Obermeyer Wood Investment Council, an independent investment advisory firm that works with individuals, corporations, and foundations through its offices in Aspen and Denver. This is Aspen Public Radio broadcasting on KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale, also broadcasting via Pitkin County Translators K216BF in Aspen, K21FAC and BC in Snowmass Village and Thomasville, K218FG and K207DT Basalt, K209EY Woody Creek, K218FE Redstone, K207EO Glenwood Springs, and on Comcast Cable on Channel 8. In just about 20 minutes, our live coverage of the Aspen Ideas Festival continues with Closing the Digital Divide. Panelists will discuss how to address the fact that 5 million households with school-aged children don't have internet at home, making it difficult for kids to keep up at school. Aspen Public Radio's full live broadcast schedule is online, aspenpublicradio.org. We go now to Performance Today, already in progress. Thanks for listening.